whatever calendar you use, the new year we have established pretty well at WFMT starts in the autumn, because that's when the cultural season starts, the school year, the academic year, the Jewish year, for those who follow that calendar, and, of course, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra season, and that season starts with its music director, Ricardo Muti. And it's always a pleasure to welcome Mr. Muti back to Chicago, because this is a second home for him now. And it's especially a pleasure at the beginning of the season, because so many things are about to happen, and many have already happened, because he packs a lot in to his early days in Chicago each year. Welcome back, Mr.
Grazie.
Muti, Maestro.
Thank you, Andrew.
You have a new record out, Romeo and Juliet Suite of Prokofiev. And this is, to me, an example of a way you are able to combine the expectations of others with reality and overturn their expectations, in that people might say, oh, Romeo and Juliet, really? This is something that we need a record of? Or hasn't the Chicago Symphony done this? In fact, they did it with Prokofiev a very long time ago. And yet, you show people different things about the piece, and you also showcase your work with the orchestra in playing this suite.
I also made a recording many years ago with the Philadelphia Orchestra, with the two suites. And this time, because we had the possibility to do Romeo and Juliet in a new combination of the different pieces of the two suites. So practically, since I was in Philadelphia, I started to make a selection between the two suites, and I made my own suite, but of the music of Prokofiev, in a way following the story from the beginning through Friar Lawrence until the last scene, then the Tybald, and the death of the two lovers. So there is, instead of two suites with numbers that can be interesting, especially for the musicians and less for the general public, this suite is concentrated on really following the root of the story of the two lovers. And the point that you underlined, is it necessary to have this? This is a question that generally is asked in several parts of the world, but about when a conductor makes programs or programs for the tours, is it necessary to do this or to do that? And one of the questions that about this problem that shocked me many years ago was when some critics asked, is it necessary to play the Beethoven symphonies or the Brahms symphonies, because we had so many historical performances, great conductors, new approaches, this and that. I think that first, a symphonic orchestra, the bread of a symphonic orchestra is the symphonic repertoire.
Of course.
I personally believe that it's a pity that now the so-called Baroque music, Bach and the composers of his period, going until the neoclassic period or classic period of Mozart, Haydn, now is becoming more and more a field of the so-called specialist. And I think that this is wrong, because to take away from the big orchestras, the symphonic orchestras, this repertoire, and making in a sort of ghetto, the symphonic orchestra should not play Bach, because the Bach is, I think that is diminishes the possibility of an orchestra and the musicians of the orchestra to grow. Now, we know that at the time of Stokowski went too far, because he played, made arrangements of Handel that were very beautiful with the, according to the taste of that time, but today don't make any sense.
Very plush.
Because sometimes the Handel sounds like Rachmaninoff.
Right.
And also the concept of Busoni making the transcriptions of the Bach toccata in D minor, with many pianists and organists playing this. So the il gusto, the
taste. Tells
us
more about the history of the il gusto, of the taste, than it tells us about Bach.
Sì, 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 certo. And for example, if we want to speak about the contemporary of Bach, actually, he was born a little bit before. It was Alessandro Scarlatti. Mm-hmm. But Alessandro Scarlatti, that almost nobody plays, was really the greatest composer of that period. And I have enjoyed in the Pfingsten Festival, in the Whitsun Festival in Salzburg, as you know also.
Right.
To play Hasse, to play Paisiello, to play Sussmayr, and Scarlatti, etc., with the classical orchestra. And of course, for example, I recorded many years ago with the Berlin Philharmonic, and I think that still now is a good recording, the Wassermusik of Handel. So I think it is a good recording for the so-called specialist. Today would be considered not stylistically right. But who knows what's stylistically right at the time of Handel. If you think that this music was conceived to be played in the big boats that were on the Thames with 200 oboe players, because in the open air and with the on the river you couldn't hear anything.
Right.
The king was eating apples, grapes, and doing something else, maybe, and they were out of tune playing this music. So this is original.
Right.
This should be original.
But I mean, it's not to say that there shouldn't also be different ways of playing things or experimenting with things. It's that the symphony orchestra should be playing from before Bach until tomorrow, right?
Sì,
I mean,
certo.
Everything in between.
I agree. Monteverdi, when I was a student at Conservatorio Milano studying composition, I made a transcription of the Sonata Sopra Sancta Maria of Monteverdi, and it was used a lot by some conductors at that time. Of course, I studied and I read many books about how to perform the Baroque music, but still you have to interpret it like a man of today. I don't believe that we can be the ghosts that become again flesh and bones of a period that we don't have any document. We can read something and we can see in the paintings what was the style, but nobody knows what was really, for example, the voice of Farinelli. Today we have a countertenor that and some very good, but what was the voice of Farinelli that made men and women crying and desperate about the expression that was so deep?
I think there's an example actually from your programs right now when we're speaking, which is late September 2014. I think there's an example that illustrates this very well without having to offend the sensibilities of different people about Baroque music, and that is, you performed on Thursday night the Opus 1, not the first piece he ever wrote, but the first piece he claimed, of Hector Berlioz, the Waverly Overture from 1826 to 1828. This orchestra is in its 124th season, and it played this piece for the first time. This is Berlioz at the beginning, before Beethoven, before his encounter with the work of Beethoven. And how can people whose bread and butter, as you would say, is Symphonie Fantastique, is Romeo and Juliet, perhaps if they play with operas, the Trojans, etc., have never played a piece that shows you where did the person come from? And to me, this is one of the most valuable things that you bring us, is this opportunity, not just for us to hear it, but for the players to play it.
See, I thank you for saying this, but, you know, it would have been much easier for me to play the Roman Carnival. It's actual, the Roman Carnival today.
Yeah.
And it's much more flamboyant piece, is it? But in the Waverly Overture, I wanted to bring, I didn't know that was the first performance, because it's interesting, the history of this orchestra is so great that every time I have the idea to play something,
right,
that the first time I've discovered that Mr. Thomas or Mr. Stock,
right,
had conducted so, but this time, for the first time, by luck, I found this piece that is incredibly Berlioz.
Yes.
Because the long line of the celli in the beginning have this nobility that you find also in the Symphonie Fantastique. And that shows already that Berlioz, since the beginning, he was writing his scores following more the lines of the contrapoint than the concept of the harmonies.
Mm-hmm.
So practically he didn't play the piano.
Mm-hmm.
He played the guitar. So his concept, like in the Symphonie Fantastique, that sometimes can seem strange in orchestration on the use of the instruments, comes from somebody that writes on the orchestrate on the page,
mm-hmm,
not
mm-hmm,
using other methods. And
I
so
Berlioz, that Maestro Muti is, when he's saying these examples, he's using his left hand in both a horizontal and a vertical way to demonstrate what he's describing.
See. And this is from the Waverly Overture, that from the orchestral point of view is already a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's Berlioz 100%.
Right.
What we will find also in the Symphonie Funèbre Triomphale, in the all this symphonic music, La Mort de Cléopâtre,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
is already in synthesis
right,
in
right,
this beautiful gem. And I was pleased that at least before I leave Chicago, one piece of the old repertoire I have conducted for the first time.
But it will be interesting, too, to see the next time, whether with you or a guest, they play Berlioz, their fingers and their lips and their minds are going to have some resonance, I think, from this experience. Just as when you do a cycle now, as you're doing of Tchaikovsky, if you see how things kind of bounce back and forth and they speak to each other across time, but within the one biography, the musical biography, the personal biography is less important.
Si, si.
Back to Prokofiev and to the recording, the suite, as you said, you've selected in a way to return to the story, return to Shakespeare. Prokofiev, especially in the early years, had a busy association with Chicago. Mr. Cyrus McCormick found him in Russia, or he found McCormick. His family, his father, managed an estate, and they used international harvester combines on the estate, so Prokofiev knew who McCormick was. McCormick was a founder or leader of the Chicago Symphony and of other institutions here, and sent the music back. Stock said, I like this. Prokofiev starts coming here as performer, conductor, composer. And he gives an interview where he says to the old Chicago Tribune, with this piece, I am going still in a tonal way, but writing kinds of melodies that people have never heard. Do you think he's right about that? Do you think he's fair?
I personally believe that the Romeo and Juliet is the best thing that Prokofiev wrote.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know that in the Third Symphony, he tried to express the real himself, the real Prokofiev, but then Stalin stopped him, as we know. And he wrote then other symphonies, like, for example, the Fifth Symphony, that is extremely popular, where he goes back, harmonically speaking, just because he had to be understood by the people of Russia. He was still able changing his natural approach to the harmonic concept and the instrumentation that he had in mind as a modern composer. Even going back, he was able to express himself. But I think that Romeo and Juliet expresses the real heart of Prokofiev. He doesn't want to show, like in the Third Symphony, how avant-garde he is, and how he's able to use the orchestra with the real using real notes, but giving the effect almost of punctilistic system of writing music. So he was really a genius, but the Romeo and Juliet, he has the courage to express the melodic lines in a very open and direct way. I still remember, you know, one of the pieces that I've not done here, but I've recorded twice, one with the Vienna Philharmonic and one with Philadelphia Orchestra, is a classical symphony,
mm-hmm.
the First Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
And that is and it's very difficult for the violins, but it's certainly the work of a genius. But I remember that when I was speaking with Sviatoslav Richter about Prokofiev, because Richter knew, like Rostropovich, they knew Prokofiev very, very well. They were friends. And I said, I would like to do the classical symphony. And he said, but the best piece in this kind of repertoire that he wrote is the Sinfonietta. So, because I worshipped Richter, in Vienna I found the score of the Sinfonietta, and I recorded the Sinfonietta that is much more Prokofiev that writes the Sinfonietta than Prokofiev that tries to be classical composer in the first. So Richter thought that the First Symphony is a masterpiece in the way Prokofiev tries to recreate the classical world.
It's a kind of exercise for Richter.
But in the end, but the Sinfonietta is the real.
Yeah.
And I recorded, when I recorded Ivan the Terrible, Ivan Groznyev,
mm-hmm.
and with the Philharmonia, and I put as a fill-up the Sinfonietta. Maybe it's the only recording that exists.
It could be.
And that maybe that would be another piece. It will be first performance when
right. when you get to that. It's interesting. I mean, I'm somebody, some readers or listeners would say, oh, Patner, he doesn't like Prokofiev. I don't like some of Prokofiev as much as other things. Of course, we come back again to Romeo and Juliet. But what I find interesting about Prokofiev, and I think is really the argument of why he's important, is I think almost every serious conductor has at least one piece that he or she is connected to.
Sure.
And interestingly, the piece that brought him to the United States and that shows you a different kind of board of trustees that Chicago has had throughout its history was the Scythian Suite. And this is a very bomb, bomb, bomb in your face, as they say. And this is the piece that Boulez will play of Prokofiev, whereas a lot of other Prokofiev, he wouldn't even roll his eyes. He wouldn't even look to see if you asked him about it. And you have the Sinfonietta via Richter, classical symphony, which was also a favorite of Giulini, recorded here. A famous recording, and there's something, even if everything isn't pure or perfect or original or original and attractive. There's something very busy going on there, from chamber music to opera to...
You know, there are two things. First, you are not alone in have some reservations about the music of Prokofiev. Radu Lupu once told me that he heard that Arau, mm-hmm. that didn't like the Prokofiev mm-hmm. piano concerto, used to say that Prokofiev, the last part of his piano concertos, always writes the word bravo. And the other story that my teacher told me about...
this is Botto?
Vitale, piano mm-hmm. piano teacher, said that one time a friend of him went to see Prokofiev in Russia, and the daughter, or the wife, I don't remember, said to him, wait here in the dining room a little bit, because my father is busy to put the wrong chords in the normal music.
After he finished the piece, he has to go back and put them in. Well, I will be very happy to know that people I idolize as well, Lupu, Arau, and
Vitale.
Richter, and I'll give Vitale through you this idolization, but it's definitely there. One of the other very positive sides of Prokofiev, which he shares with his Russian and Soviet counterparts, is almost all of them were somehow naturally hommes de théâtre. They're men of the theater, be it ballet, stage play, or opera. That's in their blood and in their history. Have you ever conducted the Romeo with a ballet?
No.
But have you seen it with the ballet? I imagine perhaps at Ravenna or something.
No, Ravenna, no. But I think...
Because it's so effective.
Si.
Yeah.
No, I don't remember that I've seen Romeo and Juliet. Maybe in television from Bolshoi.
Yeah.
You know, this, but,
the Joffrey, based now in Chicago, has a wonderful production. And I first saw it in San Francisco, where the opera house is like a castle. If you have seen Cocteau, The Beauty and the Beast, where you're with hands holding torches and so on. And to see in this castle, the War Memorial Opera House, this opera of this period, of this medieval sense, I think. And it brought me back to the music as well. And somehow he succeeds in making a ballet, making something you can just listen to, making something that is Shakespeare, and making something that is Veronese, that is Italian, isn't it? Sure. I mean, does he have an Italian sense or not?
No.
No, you're saying.
No, I'm not. I'm thinking because it's a question that is the first time that is brought to me. There is certain moments, for example, I think the Serenity that you have in the Friar Lawrence mm-hmm. number, mm-hmm. is, I don't know if it's Italian, but certainly reflects this atmosphere of these monks of that period, mm-hmm. Very serious, very spiritual, mm-hmm. and very wise, mm-hmm. no? But of course, the death of Tibaldo, that is a showpiece for every orchestra. That is a great orchestra. And at the beginning, pam 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 papi ta tam ta ta, that is real very medieval in the sense of the Italian. You see in the paintings of the great Italian painters of that period, this nobiltà, this nobil, and also arrogance these warriors, etc. But can be, you know, Capulet and Montecchi are everywhere in the world.
Right.
Somebody said that Shakespeare had to end the story with the death of Romeo and Juliet. Romeo, they had to die at a certain point, because if they had gone on in their life, then Giulietta would be always the nice lady waiting for Romeo, But the problem is that with the age, Giulietta would become old but stay on the balcony. And the poor Romero had to go up to the balcony, and with rheumatic problems of the river in Verona and the humidity, etc., he would not be able to continue to be the romantic.
On the romantic side, though, I guess maybe in my mind I make the association because one of the very first concerts that you gave with the orchestra on tour was in Verona.
Si.
And so that was my first time in Verona and my first time to see the balcony. However touristic it might be, you have a tear when you see that.
Si.
I mean, there's something, it is truly a Shakespearean discovery and creation that absolutely is universal through time and through space.
And, you know, this music, this story that gave the possibility to many composers to write their best music. Look, Romeo and Juliet of Berlioz has the most beautiful love theme, mm-hmm. as the entire symphony is that I recorded with Philadelphia, Jesse Norman. This is an incredible symphony, but it's the best love theme of the love story between the two. The same the short fantasy overture of Tchaikovsky, as the love theme is right. A beautiful melody, and in Bellini, Capuleti e Montecchi, si. The music of Giulietta, mm-hmm. it's so beautiful. So mm-hmm. everybody has been touched by this right. Truly spiritual, innocent love mm-hmm. that ends in the blood. And this story also, I think, that touched the heart of Prokofiev more than any other thing that he has written.
We're speaking with Ricardo Muti in late September 2014, and we've been speaking of the new CSO ReSound release of the Muti Suite, we can say, the Chicago Muti Suite of Romeo and Juliet of Serge Prokofiev. You're getting ready to take the orchestra on another European tour, and it's going to start with a visit that really will resonate for many people, both where you're going and where you're coming from. And that is because we are in the second largest Polish city in the world, and you're going to take the orchestra to the largest Polish city in the world, which happens to be in Poland, the capital, Warsaw. And there's some excitement, I think, that the orchestra will make its debut after decades in this important historic capital, the home of Chopin and of so much literature and history. You're bringing a Polish piece with you by Andrzej Panufnik, and wondering if you could talk a bit about this part of the tour.
See, I have been in Warsaw two times, mm-hmm. I think, one with the Vienna Philharmonic, if I'm not wrong, and one time with La Scala Orchestra. And in Warsaw, you have a fantastic public, also because, as you said, it's a very cultivated, musically speaking. And the history of the music in this city goes back that people don't know how old it is. And in fact, the piece of Panufnik gives justice to the fact, because we do, when we say Poland, immediately we think about Chopin, that they say Chopin, pronounced, because Chopin comes from Paris when he was, etc. But then we think about Penderecki and, you know, all these composers
20th century.
Of the 20th century. But we don't think that the music started there very, very early. Mm-hmm. And the Panofnik had the idea to write a wonderful piece of music in the style of the medieval Renaissance atmosphere, and gave to the solo trumpet the melodic line with a small orchestra with a harp, strings and harp and timpani. So we can feel, we can hear the melodic lines that were part of the tradition in Poland, and that tell us that this is the same music that you heard in Italy, that you heard in France, that you heard in Holland. And so Europe was culturally much more united then than today. Today is united by the euro, but by nothing else.
Yeah, and barely by that.
So this is a great tribute that he has given to the memory of the culture of his country from Panofnik. When I do the piece here in Chicago, I've put in the second part the third symphony of Tchaikovsky that is called Polish. It's the Polish,
Polaka. It's a famous Polonaise.
And this is, again, as a, I wanted to play that symphony to connect with the first piece of the evening. And this is the beginning of the tour where the orchestra will make its debut. And then we go back to Luxembourg, because we have been there two times with a great, I opened the hall there with the Philharmonia Orchestra, but the orchestra, our orchestra made such an impression that they would like to have us every year there.
The Luxembourg era of the Chicago Symphony.
Then we go to Geneva.
First time that the orchestra has been.
Also?
Yes.
Oh, that I didn't know. Time in Geneva.
First time, yeah. But of course, for many decades, Geneva didn't allow music. So, in the period of harsh Protestant reform, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau.
I've been in Geneva a few times. And then we go to Paris.
Yeah. But not yet to the new hall in Paris. Have you had a chance to see that yet, the Philharmonie?
Not yet. So we go to Salle Pleyel.
Right.
And in Paris, I have changed the program because I had put the divine poem,
Scriabin.
The Scriabin, that I will do in other places during the tour. But then I realized that I had done the piece with Orchestre National de France four or five months ago.
Okay. You want to show you have more goods, not only the special.
So I put the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony that the orchestra plays.
I didn't mean that to sound
No,
mean.
No, I know, okay. I know. The orchestra musicians are very happy to play the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony. And then we go to...
A little town that you have some history with.
Ah, si. Vienna this year. 44 years with the Vienna Philharmonic, and many, many performances in Vienna. Two, 3 years ago, speaking about Austria, I celebrated, and they made a sort of celebration in Salzburg because I did a concert 2-3 years ago that was my 200th performance in Salzburg.
Wow.
So after Karajan, the conductor that has done much more performances between operas and concerts.
And a nicer guy, too.
And then in Vienna, we will have the residency.
Right.
1 week, we do three programs.
And I know the orchestra is very excited about a residency, about Vienna, about the Musikverein, about Vienna with you, and about the range of programs.
And we do the Verdi Requiem also as the last program with the Singverein, a very famous chorus of Vienna. So this will be the end of the tour. And I know already that Salzburg would like in 2 years, 2-3 years to have again the orchestra there. And already Mr. Angian of the Musikverein is planning to have the orchestra back in Vienna.
Yeah.
So, and this is part of my idea for the future, not only to do more here in Chicago and for Chicago, but to make more international the orchestra. Right. And this not only about with tours, but also we have in the future, we have to make some new approaches in the mediatic system, like the Berlin Philharmonic is doing. You can hear directly the concerts, etc., etc.
They have this concert hall online.
So we must follow this way because the orchestra deserves this kind of exposure to the world. And this, I think, this will be part of my next commitments with the new president and new team in the future.
The new president is starting in January, but of course you've met him and he has been in Chicago since his position was announced. He seems to have a real climbing up the ladder in a good way experience, that he has learned every aspect from graduation as a French horn player. He began his first jobs learning each part of the way an orchestra works, Jeff Alexander, and he's going to be coming to us from Vancouver, where he's been for 14 years, and he was at the other CSO, Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, whose music director was also Theodore Thomas before he founded Chicago Symphony Orchestra. So he seems to have a very good grounding. What was it that you felt
connected when I met three candidates before giving my, let's say, opinion? They were interesting, all three, but I was impressed by the human aspect. I knew that he was an horn player, but he had been at the concert here with the Mahler when I did the Schubert 4 and Mahler 1, and his observations, his comments were not the usual comments, you know, that was good yesterday, but deep. It was clear that the person has a deep deep understanding of the music. That is a very important thing for a president of a big musical institution like this. Then I was impressed by the fact that he didn't want to impress me.
Yeah.
You know, in these occasions, to get to your position, you try to put like a couple, when the boy and girl or two persons or two people they meet, they try always to put on the table the best qualities, maybe lying also, and then the future discovers the reality.
Right.
So the fact that he didn't need to do this, but he was very simple, he was very open, and he was himself.
Yes.
And that I found very honest.
Yes.
And I found his eyes honest.
Yes.
So a person of experience, a person with a calm attitude, knowledge of music, and I think is what we need. Somebody said, but we want to have a flamboyant person, you know.
Really?
Not somebody here.
No,
generally,
no, but I mean that
generally,
would
you know,
say that
you need to have a sort of star, this and that. I don't think that we have enough stars.
The star is on the stage, the orchestra, the conductors. Yeah.
You need somebody that works. And
this,
I think that he's a hard worker.
Yeah.
And I will be happy to hear his ideas. And I know that he's ready to hear the ideas. I think that also the orchestra was very well impressed when we introduced him to the orchestra. He said very few simple words. And
we should underscore the committee that got to the point of presenting candidates to the board and to you was made up of a board of trustee members, staff members, and three musicians.
Yeah,
so they were involved from the beginning. This was the first time anywhere,
because
probably.
I wanted this.
Yeah,
this.
Yeah,
I wanted the musicians because this is a typically European way.
Yeah, right.
So I said, you cannot avoid the presence of the musicians.
Yeah.
In there. And I wanted the two representatives of the orchestra, Steve Lester and Jim
Smeltzer.
And the concertmeister.
Right, Robert Shen.
So it was the first time. And it's interesting that when the committee, this committee of the orchestra, met Jeff Alexander, and they had, you know, the opinion, their opinion in the end, I didn't know their opinion, but we found out that I and the committee had the same I had chosen the same person. So.
We will be talking about this in the future, and we'll be talking with Jeff Alexander in the future. But an interesting additional confirmation. Of course, we can't predict the future. We have to see how somebody works out, but I think the signs are all very good. But I was most impressed that in Vancouver, not only his direct colleagues, but the newspapers, all the other arts organizations, all the other music figures in Vancouver were on Twitter, Facebook, the social media, were in advertisements and articles in the newspapers saying, we are so proud of Jeff Alexander, and Vancouver is really going to miss his leadership of the community and his commitment to the... Oftentimes it's, let the door hit you on the way out, you know. But this was...
Sincere,
and from people who have seen him up close now for 14 years. Yeah. So, well, the first of our several conversations we'll be having throughout the season with Ricardo Muti. He is in Chicago doing concerts through the first week of October. Then he's on tour with the orchestra October 20 through November 1st all around Europe, and Poland is very much in Europe. And then he's back in
January
of 2015. Ricardo Muti, thank you as ever. Thank you so much.
Grazie. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank, as ever, Ricardo Muti for being so generous with his time and his thoughts and his opinions. Matt DiStefano recorded and produced for broadcast this conversation, which took place at Orchestra Hall in the music director's suite. Celeste Robluski, Emily Master, Pietro Fiumara all make our Muti interviews possible, as of course does the support of our funder, Alpha Wood Foundation, and other friends of this program. You can hear this or any of our programs anytime, wfmt.com/criticalthinking, home of the always free Critical Thinking podcast. Drop me a line if you like. That's Rentap, Patner spelled backwards, rentap@aol.com. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.